The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and over the next 30 minutes, we'll bring you the headlines and the stories that are making waves across the technosphere. This week, we find out what happened to the cabal of startups that we've quizzed over the past 3 years. Where are they now? Tech Weekly hit the pavement to find out who flipped and who flopped. Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur speaks with the man who put the E in e-democracy, Stephen Clift of eDemocracy.com. Clift has been in the web politics race since 1994, and he opens up the debate about whether we should be forced to use our real names online. Joining me in the studio are Charles Arthur, the Guardian's new media correspondent, Jemima Kish, and the Guardian's head of social media development, Meg Pickard. Welcome to all of you. How are you?
We are good.
Yes, you're dressed as a Skeksi today, Jemima.
Well, it's really cold in the podcast studio, and there just happened to be a big black velvet curtain sitting in the corner, so I'm sitting in here looking like a Nazgul.
Reminiscing the days of your goth youth, I'm sure.
No, I was not a goth. I was a crusty. I resent that.
Ooh, drawing the lines. Meg, were
she's
you a
crusty
or a goth?
She's still got the strings she used to hold the dog on.
I'm afraid I was too healthy looking, too ruddy cheeked to be a goth. I was cast out of the goth society, which is a real shame for me.
There's pancake makeup for that. I'm
still working on it all these years later.
And Charles, goth or crusty?
Neither. Christ, what the hell was I? I have no idea, actually.
I could tell by all of the rearview mirrors that are sort of surrounding you at all times.
Quadrophenia, so. I did think Quadrophenia was just the best album ever in the world, I have to say.
There you go.
Okay, well, you should live in Brighton. Enough of this fishy business. Stick with Tech Weekly and let the sharks around the table help you surf the waves of technology. Over the last 3 years of this podcast, we've profiled many hopeful startups, all of whom had big ideas and even bigger dreams of turning their web concepts into massive web successes. We've heard about the gamut from social networking sites to online printers to music apps to search engines to green initiatives. But where are they now? Who's sold big and who's given up the ghost? Who's on their way to toppling the giants and who's floundered under the economic climate? Tech Weekly caught up with some of them this week, and each one's story is packed with lessons for other e-entrepreneurs.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
So who are you and what's your company?
I'm Max Jennings, co-founder of eConversions.
My name is Daniel Bauer and I head up product development on our projects.
We ran welovelocal.com and we currently run vouchercodes.co.uk.
Fourth floor. Doors opening.
Since we were in the elevator last time, a lot's changed. We've actually sold the majority stake now in welovelocal.com, and it's been acquired by a company called Global Radio. They're the largest commercial radio group in the UK. And since then, they've took over the site, they've bought majority stake, and they now run the site on a day-to-day basis. The site was growing quickly, but we knew as a company we weren't big enough to take it to the next stage. And the big part from that was obviously reach, but more importantly, integrating it with local businesses. The great thing about Global Radio is they've got 40 local radio stations across the UK, huge reach online, and they just seem like the perfect partner. And since then, we've been involved integrating it into their local radio station websites, and more importantly, building a business platform which enables small businesses to take control of their listing and market themselves, not only through welovelocal.com, but eventually through all the local radio stations.
First floor.
I think the recession has been a positive thing for us insofar as it's enabled us to recruit much better people. Prior to the recession, we found it very difficult to hire strong graduates or, people who are clearly like industry leaders in their particular field, just because we were competing with the Googles, the Microsofts, the big startups with, a lot of funding. Unfortunately for a lot of people, there's less jobs on the market, which has enabled us, as we've been hiring and growing our team, to get access to interview and meet and kind of engage with a lot more stronger candidates. So, our team's grown, we were probably about 12 when we were running We Love Local to about 30 now, and it in a small way, because of the recession, we've actually been able to get on board much, much better people. It's also enabled us to compete with bigger companies, because the first things to go are unfortunately things like the R&D and the more tech areas, or what would be considered leading edge areas, which has enabled us to compete a lot more aggressively in those markets.
Second floor.
My name is Richard Moross and I'm the founder and CEO of Moo.com.
despite feeling as though I've aged 10 years in the past 2 years, quite a lot's happened to the business. We've roughly doubled in size in terms of headcount here. The business has grown massively internationally. I suppose one of the biggest things that's happened for us is we opened an office in the US, and we've grown that to about 15 people on the ground there today. Most of our customers are in the US, the largest percentage of our customers are there. And all this time they've been ordering from us from the UK, and we've been shipping stuff up to sort of 6,000 miles away. So having production in the US has enabled us to make print cheaper for them, get there much, much quicker, and turn around orders in a much, much shorter time frame than ever before, which has been great.
Fourth floor, doors opening.
In many ways, 2010 has been our kind of intentionally most boring year as far as product development is concerned. We grew very, very quickly in our first 3 years, and we wanted to spend some time just sort of fixing and improving things. So we spent the last sort of 6 to 9 months working on a website redesign. So later this year, there'll be a relaunch of a new website. And going into 2011, we've got some very aggressive product plans, new product development and some other sort of whiz-bang technology that we're very excited about. So I'm very excited and looking forward to some of the new things that we've got coming up. But the customers will have to wait a few more months until those actually surface and become available.
My name is Ed Freifogel. I'm one of the founders of a company called Nestoria, and we do property search. So we help you if you're looking for a place to buy or to live. We provide a very simple, easy interface where you can have an overview of the entire market. And we do that in a few different countries. Since early 2008, I think at that time we had two countries, the UK and Spain, and since that time a couple things have happened. We've expanded and we're now in 6 countries. Of course, there was also some financial turbulence, especially in the real estate market, especially in markets like UK and Spain. To be honest, we were a bit worried about that, but it actually turned out very positive for us because the main effect of that was that more and more of the real estate industry has moved online and away from print. The business is profitable. We're 10 full-time employees, and we probably have about 10 part-time people and contractors and things. The immediate goal for the rest of 2010 is we're hoping to launch Brazil and India. So we're hard at work on that. In terms of the product, from day one, we focused on one thing, and that's being a very simple, easy place to get an overview of the market and find your next home. And that's it. That's all we will keep on doing. Obviously, there are technical changes, like new things like the iPhone and the iPad and things like that. But fundamentally, the core service remains exactly the same.
That was Ed Freifogel from Nestoria. Jemima, who would you say out of those has been the biggest success?
Well, obviously, they've all had their own successes, as just highlighted. But it's hard not to see Moo as the winner, actually. I mean, they're so high profile now. And moving into the US is a massive thing for a company. You can't underestimate that. I mean, it's easy to kind of assume that because it's an English-speaking market that it's very similar, and it's not. Actually, it's a massive move. And I think they've handled it really well.
Do you think that it's the idea, or do you think that they've been very reflective and reflexive about what's going on in the industry, or Do you think it's their experience in the past that's made them a success?
I think it's exactly that. It's having a good, solid starting product, but it's having the vision and the flexibility and a company that's agile enough to kind of twist and turn and adapt to what you're doing for a different market.
Meg, you've been close to Moo since the beginning. How have you seen them transform?
I think they've been really agile in understanding that, just as Jemima says, that they've had a core product that's really interesting. It's different from everything else that's out there. But what the real talent has been, or what the real kind of challenge has been figuring out how to market that and who to market that to in ways that actually allow them to continue to be successful. Because let's face it, there's only so many conference goers, tech conference goers that need a pack of novelty cards. So they had to be able to go beyond being novelty cards. And what they've actually managed to do is actually create a whole new section of the market, which is for small-time producers, for people, on Etsy, for small agencies, independents, and how can they get their personality across as well as their contact details. So I think that they've done well to actually create a new category in the market rather than just following. You can get business cards anywhere, but Moo cards are really kind of very unique.
Charles, how do you think that the stories that we heard there compare with what was happening during the explosion in the early 2000s during the boom? Do you think that people are more cautious? Do you think that there are similarities? What do you think is going on there?
I think a key difference is that there was a lot more venture capital money around, and it went into fewer companies in the first dot-com boom. So, you've got these companies which got tons of money, you know, like Boog.com, for example, or ClickMango. They got a load of money and they basically burnt through it in no time at all. And there wasn't very much that was clear because it was all sort of pushed. They were trying to offer these things. You know, Boo.com, for example, would have been okay nowadays because it would have been, you know, for a broadband world, for a flash-enabled world, it would have been fine. But back in those days, you would wait 3 minutes for the page to load. You couldn't buy anything in that sort of example because everyone was on dial-up and they had slow browsers and so on. The difference now is that people have a much lower cost base. They can use things like Amazon. They can use Google App Engine, all these sorts of things. They can get very low cost hosting, and that all means that you can run a store or a business for pretty much nothing. And if you can then work your way through to a commercial model where you're actually taking money in for what you're doing, you can start to break even and even move into profit comparatively easily. So you don't get these massive ramp ups where people are floundering around trying any sort of idea they can, trying to come up with a business plan, because, you know, the first time round people didn't know if, you know, writing lots of content would be the great way to do it, or would it be by, you know, putting lots of videos onto a site. No one really knew. The models were very much untested. So it all got, a lot of money got burnt up in that. Venture capitalists got very worried by that. And now people are doing it on a much more, much lower budget.
Jemima, we've got a nice library now. We only heard from a few of them in this piece, but we've got a nice library of startups over the past 18 months, 2 years. Do you see anything new emerging over the next 2 or 3 years in terms of the startup community? Do you see different trends emerging of different types of apps or how people will use this platform that Charles is talking about?
Well, most recently, obviously, casual gaming and location have become really, really important. And I do think there's location is one spot to watch in becoming the next major set of data that will come online and be able to monetize things in different ways. I suppose in the spotlight, Foursquare is there, but that's benefiting UK startups like Rumble, who've been there for a long time and are now reaping the benefit of all their hard work, because they're much older than Foursquare. Another really interesting issue to keep an eye on is that apps have become a really, really important way for companies to get profile and build traction and get users. But it does mean you're parasitic, in a good way, but parasitic on Facebook or Apple, and you're dependent on them for survival, which is slightly risky as much as it is useful. That's a really interesting area to watch, you know, because Facebook one day could change their terms and it's slightly risky.
Well, we will keep our eye on this space. And in fact, we'll be reinstating our elevator for future pitches. So if you would like to meet Jemima in the lift, do get in touch. Jemima.kish@guardian.co.uk. And now here's Jemima with the news.
UK broadband customers are receiving only 46% of the speeds they pay for, Ofcom has said. The communications regulator said performance has worsened in the past year, prompting consumer groups to call for an end to misleading advertising claims. The European Union is investigating IBM over claims it is abusing its dominant position in the £2.5 billion mainframe and software market. Following investigations on Intel and Microsoft, IBM could face a multi-million pound fine if found guilty. Nokia chief executive Olli-Pekka Kallasvuo appears to be facing a coup. Under pressure over Nokia's failure to compete with the iPhone, Kallasvuo challenged Nokia's chairman to end speculation about whether he would be forced to step down. And iPad owners are selfish elitists, while critics are independent geeks, according to consumer research by MyType. Bashing the iPad is a badge of honour for geeks who won't have one, while iPad fanboys and girls are typically wealthy, educated, power-hungry overachievers. All very scientific.
Thanks very much. And you can keep up with all these headlines and more stories on guardian.co.uk/technology. Stephen Clift has been playing the e-politics game since 1994. The founder of eDemocracy.com, one of the most powerful sites in the US, met with Charles Arthur at the Guardian's Activate Summit, where he talked about how websites can be used to help build trust, respect, and power. This issue has been hitting the headlines recently as newspapers grapple with the notoriously unruly online commenting culture. Clift explained to Charles why he believes that the only way to develop groups
is by asking people to use their real names.
Well, you know, I used to work in government, right? I worked in the mailroom for Joe Biden when I was an intern. And all the anonymous letters went in the trash. And so when I created this Minnesota Politics Forum back in 1994, I looked at newsgroups. If you remember newsgroups, that was where people were anonymous and there was Jewish conspiracy after conspiracy, right? It was the worst of the worst. And so I thought, well, people get power from having a real name, and they also are far more civil, and we just did it. You know, we decided that let's try it out. It was totally swimming upstream, and we haven't looked back since. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, the next folks that came along that figured it out was Facebook, right? You know, and they realized they can build on real reputation and do private networking. But unfortunately, that really doesn't reach into public life, really not into local public life where you actually don't know somebody. But if you connect people with real names, you build respect, you build trust, and you build power. That's our experience.
Do you think that that should be used for newspapers and other sort of open debate sites as well?
If you have your own blog and you're obscure, whether you use real names or not, doesn't matter. But if you're a trusted media brand, if you're a democratic institution at a national or at a local level where people trust you to bring them quality news, if that's your role, then I think you better look at real names as a way to maintain the trust in what you do. And so absolutely. I mean, I think the default for all online news commenting should be real names. People always say, oh, yeah, how can you prove it? Well, what we find is if you add a real name with the neighborhood or place, if somebody knows too much, you can pretty quickly figure out that that's not who they say they are. You know, because in a local community in particular, people know. And if you think about, like, if a national site even, if you can see, you know, what constituency they live in, a member of parliament is going to pay a lot more attention to that comment. And 80% of the problems that I think come from incivility can be dealt with real names. You still need, though, a whistleblower option. And so, you know, put that into a moderated queue. And make sure that you give people the opportunity. And it's also, you know, the reality is that politics may be a more significant space for real names versus talking recipes. And there's clearly topics that are quite sensitive. And so you could, you know, perhaps have some different ways that you might look at that. But absolutely, real name's the way to go. And any media site that doesn't do it is a site that I don't enjoy visiting very often.
So your suggestion would be that if someone wants to be anonymous, that they would mark it and say, here is my real name, but I want to stay anonymous. It goes into a moderation queue and gets examined.
I mean, that would be my suggestion for a sort of a well-established media site. You know, like I said, if you're a watchdog, anonymous blogger, and, you know, everybody's anonymous, that's fine. And I don't want the government to require us to do it, right? I want this to be a voluntary thing that the media does because it actually serves their mission to serve us in our community and in our democratic life. And I think that people adopted the no one knows you're a dog mentality because that's just what you did online. That's just what you did. And it wasn't really an intentional, let's, you know, destroy our sense of community with, you know, nasty comments among our neighbors. It was just, well, that's how you're supposed to do it. And I've realized the net is actually a medium that you can shape based on your ideals. And we've had great success with real names, and I'd love to see more media sites do this. And there are some that have done it. And those that have told me that they'll never go back to defaulting to anonymous or aliases.
That was Stephen Clift of eDemocracy.com. Now, Meg, you are a woman with almost a dozen years, 15 years of managing online communities, everyone from AOL to a whole bunch of brands that we probably have heard of. What impact would you say making sure that people use their real names has on the development of a sense of community?
So, first of all, I think that the discussion about real names is a bit of a red herring, actually, mainly because I think a lot of the times when we talk about real names, what we really want is reliable identity. What is your real name? Your real name is something that is stable, it's persistent, it's the name that you always go by, and it's a trustworthy thing. There's a reputation that goes with that. We know that you're Alex Krotowski and that travels with you wherever you are in the world.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse, right. Exactly. In your case,
there's an albatross,
mainly for better. But I guess what I'm saying here is that, you know, the idea of asking people for real names all the time is sort of, it's not always a helpful way of thinking about the problem. Because real names are meaningless without the reputation that goes with it, without the stability that you travel around, you know, that your reputation carries with it.
And of course, people develop the pseudonyms that carry those reputations, don't they? So really, I mean, are we talking, ultimately what we're talking about is this idea of social capital. We're
That's
talking about
right.
the need for reputation, aren't we?
Yes.
Rather than the need for
ensuring that people put their real names on these
sites.
That's
right. I mean, and in the case of Facebook, they've managed to map some of that social capital to your real name. So if you're signed up with Facebook, Facebook can tell with a reasonable degree of certainty whether you're real or not, not based on that you've had to provide a credit card or that they've come around to your house or that you've given them some passport details or anything like that, but because you've got a certain number of friends and you've been using it for a while. And actually, while names are very easy to make up, reputations are really hard to construct. Reputations take time and they take effort. And spammers or random trolls tend not to put in the time and the effort to nurture 150 people in a friend network and to actually participate regularly and upload photos and do lots of other things. So they're relatively easy to spot where somebody is fake versus when someone is kind of real in that sense.
The argument for having real names mm-hmm. is that there is a direct link. And in many ways, because your real name is there, your real profile is there, it's almost as if it's a mirror. And suddenly you're more self-aware. You wouldn't go out there and troll. You wouldn't go out there and create disruption.
I mean, on some of the comment threads, for example, on the technology site, things just go mad and people just start, you know, slagging each other off. And there's no content to it. And one starts to feel that, well, if you had to use each other's, you know, if you had to use your real names or something that approached it and you were, in effect, putting yourself out there, then wouldn't you actually engage with the question more rather than just slagging someone off?
Putting yourself out there, equating putting yourself out there with using your real name is dangerous because actually people put themselves out there all the time but are not able to use their real names for legitimate reasons of privacy or because anonymity is actually part of the story. An example of this is we had a piece that was published fairly recently about the number of rapes that go unreported. And we had a commenter that commented after the piece in Comment is Free who spoke about the details of her rape and why she had chosen not to report it. Can you imagine a situation in which that commenter would feel comfortable using her real identity, as in her Facebook interaction
but,
or whatever?
But that's what Stephen Clift says, was that where you have someone who's commenting anonymously like that, you put it into a moderation queue, someone looks at it and says, okay, well, this should certainly go through without the person's name on. I mean, equally, I take the point that you don't need to force everyone to have their real name, you know, I am Stephen Johnson or whatever, on the comments. But you'd sort of want it to be consistent across a lot of sites. So, you know, for example, I use my name pretty much on all the sites I go to. I mean, on The Guardian, we have the recommend, where you can, in effect, you're sort of modding up people's things. But there's not an equal thing to mod down to sort of take out a lot of the noise that gets generated.
Well, we're doing lots of things with the Guardian community platform to figure out ways to make reputation more part of that story. And I think some of that might be to do with modding up and modding down, and some of that actually might be more to do with figuring out where somebody is particularly interesting or engaged in a particular community. So, for example, you know, my screen name may comment across the entire site, but you should really listen to me a little bit more when we're talking about, you know, food and technology than when I'm talking about football, because blatantly I don't know the first thing about football, even if I do occasionally comment there. So it's about being able to sort of understand contextual reputation and contextual relevance. And I think this is what we kind of come back to with, you know, the idea of reputations and how they travel with you is one of the reasons that we instigated putting profiles on the Guardian page, or, you know, not just for contributors above the line, but also for contributors below the line, i.e. commenters, was because your reputation travels with you like a backpack. You know, that everything that you've said is there and available, which means that people can kind of look up, you know, has Charles disagreed with himself here? Is this something that you kind of, is this your hot topic? Is this what you come back to again and again and again? Which also means that it's something that you really don't want to lose, which makes commenting rather less of a thing that you can do a sort of drive-by commenting activity around, and actually something at your identity, even if your identity is Meg loves music rather than Meg Picard, here's my address, you know, everything else, it becomes something that's actually worth losing, or, you know, that you really don't want to get rid of.
So for more on this debate, do go to guardian.co.uk/commentisfree, where the discussion about this particular topic continues to rage months later in readers' comments. So you may have noticed that we've been littering, we've been dribbling fish-related comments throughout the entire podcast, and that's because I've become rather obsessed with something that's happening on Twitter called fish pop. It's effectively you swap a nautical word for a word in a band. For example, and we came up with these a couple of weeks ago, Atlantis Morissette. No, you have to laugh. Come on, that is funny.
Do we have to laugh?
You have to laugh. And I particularly like Pulpo. But you can also do things like Squid Vicious or Piranorama, for example, things like that. So in preparation for the program, what we did was we got together and we had a serious belly laugh about this. And so what we thought we'd do to close out the program is just very quickly go around the room, Charles, with your favorite fish pop.
Oh, well, obviously, my favorite band would have to be Breams of the Stone Age.
Oh, that's bad.
And their sort of spin-off band, Them Crooked Pilchards. Arctic Monkfish.
Oh, that one's good. I like Arctic Monkfish.
I've got a double hitter here, which is Bob Marlin and the Wailers.
Oh, that's very good.
There's the real ones, De La Soul. And
oh,
Eels.
No. Not De La Soul, De La Lemon Soul.
De La Lemon Soul.
Thank you very much. We did that one the other day. Jemima, what are yours?
Mullet and Sons. Oh, Snoop Dogfish. Metallicod.
Hey.
Fergal White Sharky.
Hey.
The Shoals.
Hey.
Elfish Costello.
Hey.
And Meg, you've been furiously scribbling, and I imagine that it's not going to be Sly and the Family Rockfish that you came up with.
My favourites of the extensive list that I spent my morning on are Cliff Pilchard.
Hey.
Some members of the Beatles. We've got Ringo Starfish and Paul McErle. of course, the guy that used to sing in the lead singer of Police, which is Stingray. Sorry. My favourite at the moment actually is Sushi and the Banshees.
Hey, that's very good.
Salmon Cook, don't forget, he's a soul man.
Oh, no.
And I think the Stonefish Roses. And my favourite of all is Bruce Springsteen, not a fishy name, but his hit is Prawn in the USA.
Hey. Well done. So, yes, just stick the hashtag fishpop into Twitter and you will find, believe me, you will find this and many, many more. Thank you very much to Charles Arthur, Jemima Kish, and Meg Pickard in the studio. I'm Alex Kratowski. The producer was Scott Colley. Come back next week when we'll be listening closely to what makes video games great. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.